From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Humanitarian aid work has never been tougher. Since 1971, Doctors Without Borders has been in the thick of it. In 1999, they won the Nobel Prize for their extraordinary mission of medical relief. From Sudan to Somalia, from the Congo to Colombia, in the deserts of Darfur and beyond, they're there. But it's getting harder. This hour on Point, we're talking about humanitarian aid in a very tough time and what it takes to get it done with the head of Doctors Without Borders, USA. You can join the conversation. Have you seen the work of Doctors Without Borders? Have you been on the front lines of extreme humanitarian work? And when war comes and soldiers are chasing hearts and minds, what's left for the NGO, the humanitarian? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me first today with the latest from a very tough arena in Africa is Simon Robinson. He's Africa Bureau Chief for Time Magazine, joins us from Johannesburg, South Africa. He's been watching events in Somalia and Mogadishu, a country that has not had a government for a very long time. Simon, can you describe what's happened there in the last week?
Good morning, Tom. Sure. Over the last 3 months, there's been a lot of fighting in Mogadishu, which is the old capital of Somalia. Somalia hasn't had a government for about 15 years, an organized government. And over the last 3 months, there's been a lot of fighting basically between warlords who have essentially run most of the countries over those last 15 years and a group of Islamic clerics or Islamic lawmakers who were over the last probably decade have come up in influence in Mogadishu and finally have taken the warlords on, and on Monday announced that they now controlled Mogadishu and had pushed all the warlords at least to the fringes of the city, and over the last couple of days have pushed them even further out and now say that they want to kind of unify the country and get rid of the warlords altogether bring back some semblance of order.
This in what has been one of the least governed and most ungovernable countries on earth. The warlords reported to have been supported by the United States through the CIA. Is that confirmed?
That's not confirmed. I mean, the U.S. Government or the State Department or the various arms of the U.S. government haven't confirmed that. They haven't denied it either. There's been reports over the last month, especially in the Washington Post, about links to the CIA and to the U.S.'s war on terror. The thinking is that the U.S. saw the warlords as a way to stop these Islamic clerics gaining more power. And various groups, including the Islamic clerics, including the officials from the transitional federal government, which was set up about 2 years ago to hopefully take control of Somalia, set up with the help of the international community. It's a government that hasn't really got any power as such at this stage. They both say that the U.S. has been helping funding the warlords.
Of course, the U.S. went into Somalia on a relief mission under President George H.W. Bush in a time of hunger and woe there. Then came Black Hawk Down and the dead U.S. Army Rangers and the pullout of the U.S. and the U.N. and everybody else. Now here you've got it in the Horn of Africa, this ungovernable place dominated, at least for the moment, by Islamic clerics. Does that put it in the camp of international terrorism?
Well, that's the big concern, and the White House, I know, is very concerned about that. The State Department made a statement on Monday when, right after the clerics announced they gained control of Mogadishu, that it was a very worrying turn. At the same time, you have a lot of people who know Somalia well, who have spent many years watching this place, and they say, while there is reason to be concerned, at the same time, Somalis aren't Afghanis, they're perhaps a little more secular. They're unlikely to be able to harbor terrorists in the same way as the Taliban harbored Al-Qaeda, and that actually this might be an opportunity to get that transitional government strengthened a bit, get it into Mogadishu, and perhaps if the Islamic clerics give it a bit of space to actually have some sort of a functioning government. At the moment, of course, the Islamic clerics do control only Mogadishu, so it's certainly not like they control the whole of the country.
And you're reporting that they say they are. And you're reporting that they say they are not interested in becoming another pre-9/11 Afghanistan.
They're actually sending mixed signals. They sent a letter yesterday, which I saw, and they sent that to the U.S., to various powerful African countries, to the U.N., to the EU. They say in that that they have nothing to do with terrorism. They don't harbor terrorists. They will not harbor terrorists. They invite the international community to visit Somalia and Mogadishu to help them to rebuild a peaceful and stable country, which all sounds great. At the same time, the head of the Islamic courts spoke yesterday at a rally in Mogadishu and said that they'll keep fighting until they have an Islamic State. So I think it's still a bit unclear as to what their plans are. One of the problems has been it's the fighting in Mogadishu has made it very, very dangerous, and very few journalists have actually gone there.
Mm. Mm. A failed state that may or may not become another Afghanistan. Simon Robinson, Time Magazine's Africa Bureau Chief in Johannesburg. Thank you very much for joining us, Simon.
Thank you.
Joining me now in the studio is the executive director of Doctors Without Borders USA, Nicola De Torrente. He's been with the organization for a decade. Before becoming executive director here, he was head of the group's missions in Tanzania and Rwanda, was emergency coordinator in Somalia, Liberia, and the Democratic Republic of Congo, Macedonia, and Afghanistan, and was advisor on the agency's work in Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Guinea. He's been around. Nicola De Torrente, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
There's a lot we want to learn in this time when governments and militaries are reaching out into all kinds of troubled corners of the world, doing nation building, building schools, bringing relief at the same time. Lots of relief agencies are there. But I want to start, if we could, you've been out there a lot, and just to get a sense of how it works, whether in Somalia or in Darfur or the Congo, these super troubled spots where Doctors Without Borders go to work, how does it work? When a crisis breaks, how do you get in there? What do you bring? What's the work you do?
Well, the starting point is that we're trying to reach people who are caught up in and affected by conflict and acute crisis. And we, you know, the reality is that today's conflicts really center around controlling and civilian groups, harming civilian groups, massacring them, forcibly displacing them.
Not army on army very often, but really armed people on unarmed civilians.
Yes, and that's you know, if you look at the casualties, it's clearly one to 10 in terms of, you know, armed combatants being wounded or killed versus civilians. I mean, the civilians really bear the brunt of these conflicts, and Somalia is no exception to that, a place that we've worked in for over a decade now.
Are you still there?
We are still there working in very difficult conditions, very difficult security conditions. And it's perhaps an extreme example of how tough it is to reach people, because essentially it's a very simple idea. You want to reach the people who are the worst off and provide assistance to them, and you have to navigate the politics that and the wars that cause the suffering in the first place. And
so
you're coming up
coming
up against the ones who are actually creating the suffering. So you have to convince them basically to allow you to go in and to work. The way you convince is you talk. I worked in Somalia and I spent all my days just meeting whoever's in charge. I mean, that's the basic principle. You go on the ground and you meet whoever's in control, in charge.
And Doctors Without Borders cutting its own deal, saying that with this warlord and that warlord.
Yes, that's the reality of the on the ground. You have to go out and reach out to everyone and to explain to them that you're there to provide this assistance. You have no other designs, that you don't have any religious agenda, political agenda, economic agenda. You're just there to provide the assistance. And you... And you have to back it up. I mean, you have to back it up with the wherewithal to actually make a difference in terms of setting up hospitals, setting up nutritional centers, and actually improving the situation. So it's a combination of being principled and working very hard on convincing and having the effectiveness to actually do the job. And both reinforce each other. When we work in Somalia, and we had a surgical hospital in one of the big cities, port cities, Kismayo, mm-hmm. that was under huge amount of conflict, the fact that we were actually being able to treat patients, including sometimes some of the
warlord's kid,
and the wounded soldiers, mm-hmm. and so on. There was a, you know, that we had a credibility that allowed us to be able to try to maintain our programs in very tough, in very, very tough conditions.
Do you go in armed? The last time I was in Mogadishu was 10 years ago. Yeah. Now I had to have six gunmen to get from the fortified UN airport to the empty hotel. Do you go armed?
Yes, Somalia is the exceptional place where, as you've just pointed out, any foreigner that goes into Somalia, because of the nature of the clan system and the political system, the absence of any overarching authority, as foreigners, we are really naked in a sense, and we don't have a clan backing us, since that's the main mechanism to redress conflicts and establish some kind of order in the country. We are basically clanless, and therefore we need to have protection. And it's the one place where, you know, biting our fingernails, we actually decided, and without after a lot of discussion, to because of the gravity of the situation, to actually do something that we don't do elsewhere, which is to hire armed men to protect our operations and our staff.
But in other environments, it's gotten so bad you've actually pulled out. Iraq and Afghanistan, in particular, you're no longer there.
That's correct. Those two countries, we've had not just Doctors Without Borders, but there's been a number of targeted and direct attacks against aid workers, international and national. We've had five of our colleagues murdered in Afghanistan, and there we could not convince you know those who were trying to harm us to respect our presence, and in that case we've had to pull out.
We'll talk about that when we come back. We're looking at humanitarian aid efforts in a very tough time with the head of one of the toughest humanitarian groups out there, Doctors Without Borders. The U.S. head is with me. You can join us. Do you know how these relief dollars you send to Oxfam and Save the Children and Doctors Without Borders actually go to work on the ground? And can you imagine being there trying to feed and clothe and save lives in Darfur, in Congo, in war zones? We're at 800-423-TALK. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about humanitarian aid efforts in a very tough time globally with the U.S. head of one of the toughest humanitarian groups out there, Doctors Without Borders. Nicola De Torrente is my guest. He's executive director of Doctors Without Borders USA. You can join this conversation. Have you been on these front lines delivering aid where it's really tough? And when the U.S. and NATO and the U.N. are sending out armies with political agendas, how do aid workers stay neutral, just focused on saving lives? Can they? Should they? Have you seen the work of Doctors Without Borders? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Nobel Prize-winning organization at work in many countries, the toughest countries and settings around the world. Nicola De Torrente mentioned it, but it was a bad moment, 2004, July 28th, when Doctors Without Borders, Médecins Sans Frontières, pulled out of Afghanistan. Here's a BBC report, Andrew North reporting from that time about the pullout.
The last straw, the murder of five MSF workers in June. They say the government's done nothing to find those responsible. And worse, they say they can't provide help when coalition troops have put them at risk by doing their own aid work.
By doing so, providing aid is no longer perceived as being a neutral and impartial act. And this is endangering humanitarian aid worker, and this is jeopardizing the assistance to the Afghan people.
And here, in a way, is one nub of it, Nicola De Torrente. You have big armies, including the United States Army, now doing a lot of hearts and minds work, building schools, putting in sewage, the kind of thing Oxfam used to do around water, reaching out in all kinds of arenas with humanitarian work of a kind, right alongside their military and political goals. In Afghanistan, that left you guys, ultimately, five dead and the organization out. Do we have a blurring of the line here between humanitarian work and big political military agendas, and what's the consequence of that?
Well, a couple of points. First, this is happening in very specific contexts. It's happening in Iraq. It's happening in Afghanistan. In most conflicts that we work in, if you take the Democratic Republic of Congo, if you take Sudan, mm-hmm. if you take Somalia, we are, this is not taking place in the sense that aid organizations are on the ground and on the front lines themselves, and there are no or very few UN or other troops around, and we're still mm-hmm. in a situation to be able to deal directly with the forces in presence. So it is in a bit of an exceptional situation. What is happening in Afghanistan and Iraq? The second thing is that those who are responsible for this and who have driven us out of Afghanistan is not the primary responsible. It's not the U.S. Army. It's not the United States. It's the groups that have been decided to target aid workers and kill them, and that's a crime.
And a Taliban spokesman actually claimed responsibility yes. for those murders at the time.
Yes, he did, and we've been trying to get this claim and the credit that he took and that threat to continue to attack us and attack other aid workers. Revoked. It has not been possible until this time.
But the Taliban spokesman said you work for American interests. That was the charge. And is that the tag that humanitarian groups now wear around their neck in a time of preemptive war, in a time of, you know,
yes.
power projection?
Well, the calculation of these groups seems to be that, they want to get at the U.S. And the U.S.-backed Afghan government. And they have many ways of doing that. One of the ways is to attack aid organizations because they feel that the aid is being associated with the political military efforts of the U.S. And the U.S. has clearly said in the justification for the war that it's, of course, to rid Afghanistan of terrorists, but also to improve the welfare of the Afghan people, to improve conditions, and has co-opted aid organizations to work alongside it. Early on in Afghanistan, Colin Powell, then Secretary of State, said, in a statement to U.S. Non-government organizations that they were, quote, force multipliers in the effort in the war on terrorism, and that they were, quote, an essential part of the U.S.'s combat team.
And some of them very heavily government-supported. CARE and CRS, the Catholic Relief Services U.S., I mean, very, very high percentage of government support. On the other hand, is that a problem? I mean, CARE has been, ever since the end of World War II, for example, they've been out affiliated with the U.S. government, delivering food and a lot of other kinds of mercy. Is that a problem?
Well, it's not necessarily a problem in all contexts. It's not necessarily a problem in stable situations where they're doing development aid, which CARE does a lot of and CRS do a lot of. But clearly in conflict situations, especially when the U.S. is directly involved in military operations, being associated with them or being perceived to be associated puts increase the likelihood of attacks, puts aid workers more at risk, and feeds into the calculation of these groups that this is a way to get at the United States. And this is the dynamic that we've seen in Afghanistan and Iraq.
We're going to look more deeply at that. I'm talking with Nicola De Torrente. He's executive director of Doctors Without Borders USA, and you heard his background. He's worked all over. So does this organization. We're going to hear in a few minutes from a retired American Army major general about the military perspective on humanitarian aid these days. But there are many facets on this. We'd like to hear from you as well. 800-423-TALK. Toby's calling from Lawrence, Massachusetts. Hi, Toby. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
What do you think, Toby?
Well, I wanted to call and raise the question of whether it might be better to teach a man to fish rather than give a man to fish. If your guest saw a new role in training and funding local healthcare workers who are already on the ground as maybe a longer-lasting and more cost-effective way of responding to humanitarian crises.
Toby, let us pick it up. We hear it, and I know this is an issue you've thought and written about, Nicola Torrente, whether to be a first responder coming in from outside, whether to dig in for the long term. What about locals?
Well, I think as a general principle, the caller has said does make sense. Of course, you want to have local capacity and have countries and healthcare workers be able to respond and not have the need for outsiders. However, that's not a realistic proposition in places that are war-torn, where the health system has collapsed, that are completely devastated. I mean, to give you an example, when we first started to be able to work in Darfur, there was, one medical doctor for the whole of West Darfur. This is an area, that is the size of the state of Massachusetts. I mean, mm-hmm. this is, there is no capacity. There is no structure. There is a need, absolutely a need for outsiders in terms of to be able to bring in staff and supplies and to set up the systems. And there's a need also for a neutral presence in this, a presence that allows people from whichever side, whichever affiliation, to be treated, because that's another problem in war zones, is that government health systems may be biased. There may be an exclusion of certain populations, and that outsiders can, especially if they're humanitarian, can provide access to all groups.
But so, as I understand it, you've made a decision as Doctors Without Borders not to go for the long-term development role, but to stay with that emergency
situation.
We have definitely
decided to stay with responding to the immediate needs, the immediate crisis, the most acute phase, and
why?
We feel that that's a necessary role to be played, that it's important. You can't think of development if most of the population is dead. So you have to first allow people to survive. It's a precondition to be able to move on, and others can then bring it forward. We've decided to focus on the immediate needs and to deal with those, highlighting of course the issues that need to be taken care for the long haul, and the conditions that created the problem in the first place, causes.
Mm.
Give you an example. We're responding to a major cholera epidemic in Angola today.
Mm-hmm.
There have been 35,000 cases, 1,500 deaths. This is a country that's emerged from civil war. It has oil resources. It could be a wealthy place. Cholera epidemic. Why is that? We have decided to respond to the needs and set up cholera treatment centers, at the same time highlighting the appalling conditions that people are living, the lack of sanitation, clean water, etc., and the responsibilities of governments, and particularly the Angolan government, to deal with that, the immediate causes that allowed an epidemic like this to flourish.
It's right in your charter saying speaking out about the suffering, not only addressing it. Douglas is calling from Wilton, New Hampshire. Hi, Douglas. You're on the air.
Yes, sir. My question was... with regard to volunteering for the organization, what are the skills that they use? Clearly they use doctors, but what is the full range, and how do people volunteer to become members of it?
Well, yeah, thanks for that question. And it's the same for most aid organizations. We need a variety of skills in the field. We have, of course, medical staff, surgeons, medical doctors, pediatricians, infectious disease specialists, also paramedical staff, nurses, midwives, lab technicians, pharmacists. And then we have the non-medical side of it, with logisticians, people who bring in the supplies, organize the supplies. It's an essential part of it. You cannot, just send a doctor with good intentions and their skill if they don't have the tools, they don't have the medicines, they don't have the it's the backbone of the operation. And then we have administrative staff, finance, to deal with the finances, the budgets, the hiring staff. We employ, we have about 2,000 international volunteers, aid workers on the ground at any given time, but we employ 20,000 or more than 20,000 national staff. We work, these are teams.
Local, wherever you're operating.
So we work a lot. We have the international staff working alongside national staff, doctors and others in the field. So someone has to deal with that. We're an employer as well. So these are the skill sets that are needed. And we have a website that's very that's quite comprehensive on how you can volunteer, what are the requirements. But basically, technical skills are important, but also the capacity to adapt, to be able to work in a team in tough environments, and the time commitment. We ask people to go out for 6 months to a year because we don't want to have a very short turnover of teams that are very disruptive.
So it's a serious commitment. What's the website?
DoctorsWithoutBorders.org.
Douglas, check it out. I want to turn to this issue of what happens when there are military and political agendas at work in troubled terrain alongside humanitarian efforts. Doctors Without Borders describes their work as independent humanitarian action that goes directly at needs, not on political, economic, or religious agendas or interests. Retired Army Major General William Nash is with us from Washington, D.C. He's a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, was commander of U.S. Army forces that went into Bosnia after the Dayton Peace Accords in 1995. General Nash, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Nicola De Torrente heads up Doctors Without Borders USA, says his group feels torn when you get a kind of military hearts and minds project going. It's hard to work alongside that without becoming associated with it, and therefore losing neutrality, and therefore losing effectiveness. What do you say to that, General Nash?
Well, I'm saying I certainly understand his views and position, and put me on the list of folks that have great admiration and respect for Doctors Without Borders.
Will do.
Having worked with them many times. But when military forces are committed by the National Command Authority, and we'll just talk about the United States, by the President,
okay.
They obviously have a mission to do and a political objective to achieve through the use of force, preferably by presence rather than what we now call kinetic operations.
That is violence.
Violence, right. And humanitarian organizations that focus on being neutral and providing food, water, shelter, medical care to those who are suffering certainly have a right to do so, but again, the military forces are going to operate in accordance with the directives of their National Command Authority. Now, Dr. DeTorrente is absolutely correct to say that Afghanistan and Iraq are exceptions to most of the issues that we faced in this arena in the last dozen or so years.
But exceptions with a lot of attention right now. The military or the government, in fact, does a lot of contract, in effect, work through non-governmental organizations.
That's right. And I think we need to distinguish, first of all, that there are many different types of non-governmental organizations. And they are just that. There are some that are focused on humanitarian. There are some focused on nonprofit. There are some contractors that work for profit in the delivery of aid and assistance in foreign countries.
Nicholas DeTorrente, as you look forward with the strong power projection we see, and it may go on for a while, is it a threat to humanitarian work itself long term? You've got a political agenda, kind of geostrategic agendas, but there's the fundamental humanitarian agenda. Is that at risk in the kind of environment that General Nash describes?
Well, I think it's clearly more difficult for us to distinguish ourselves and to maintain a distance and to gain acceptance for an independent and neutral humanitarian action. General Nash is right in terms of the variety of aid organizations, but for an Afghan farmer, or even for an Afghan local commander, it's very hard to see the fine line between a contractor that works for profit, an NGO that has government funding and wants to be associated, and those who want to be outside of it.
Right.
For him, for these people, you forgive them for not seeing these fine differences, especially in the military as well. The military has in Afghanistan, worked in civilian clothing with concealed weapons and portrayed their work as humanitarian. So there is a lot of what has been called blurring of lines, which is more willful association really on the part of the military there. And it's harder for us to maintain the perception of independence on the part that on the part of the recipient groups. We have the same, by and large, the same origins. We are all, by and large, still, Western-based mm-hmm. and funded, even if we're funded from private sources and don't have government support, especially not in these kinds of conflict situations. It's very hard. So it's a constant battle. I think it's one that can be won over time. It's not possible in Iraq and Afghanistan to have that clear distinction. I think mm-hmm. we need to work on it a lot more. We need to make to diversify the composition of our teams, the sources of support. We need to have more support, not just in Western countries, but in many of the countries that are around the world, in Africa and in Latin America.
So it's not just the West reaching out, but
exactly.
A kind of global
We need to be seen much more as really an international or a universal type of organization, rather than just a Western one. And that's going to be a helpful step in that direction. But it's a very tough endeavor, and it's one that we are still able to do. And in many places we're still able to maintain that. And in a place like Ivory Coast or in Haiti, etc., where there are UN troops working, where there are organizations that are associated with them, we have been able to reach out on all sides and not be affiliated with them, and to be able to continue to work in a humanitarian way. But it's a tough effort.
General Nash, I've got one more question. If you can stick with us through a a break here. I hope I can put it to you. We're so glad to have you with us today. Nicola De Torrente, head of Doctors Without Borders USA. Listeners, you can join us. What does it mean that this group cannot work in Iraq, cannot work in Afghanistan? Is the NGO, the humanitarian, still sacred, separate, apart, or not? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com. And RHR International, an executive and organizational development firm committed to integrating executives into new roles.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about humanitarian efforts in a very tough time globally and what it means when the line is blurred between humanitarian aid and hearts and minds, military campaigns. It's a tough situation out there. My guest is Nicola De Torrente. He's executive director of Doctors Without Borders USA. We've also been joined from Washington by retired Army Major General William Nash. He was commander of U.S. Army forces that went into Bosnia after the Dayton Peace Accords in 1995. He's seen a lot firsthand. You can join us as well. Have you been there on these front lines delivering aid where it's really tough? And is the NGO, the humanitarian, still sacred, separate, and apart, or has the whole project become politicized? Is that proper that it has? 800-423, is it necessary? 423-8255, that's 800-423-TALK. General Nash, let me put it to you. Do you see the neutrality and independence of humanitarian efforts becoming a kind of casualty of war when battle lines are so widespread?
Well, when there is an outside intervention for a political purpose, they very easily can be compromised, their neutrality be compromised. One thing that Nicola said earlier that I too have a problem with was when the military is not clear that they're military, and the instances in Afghanistan where American forces were wearing civilian clothes, were carrying hidden weapons and the like, they added to the confusion and probably... I would argue not to anybody's advantage because of the nature of what took place as a result. But you can expect that confusion to take place when there are military operations ongoing in the pursuit of duly authorized objectives.
But do you fear that humanitarian groups, not soldiers in civvies, but humanitarian groups working hand in glove with a military strategy, themselves become kind of tainted? Do we see erosion of the essential idea of independent humanitarian thrust?
The answer to your question is yes. And when you use the expression like working hand in glove, I'm sure the Médecins Sans Frontières gets...
Well, they would say they will not do that, but others effectively do.
Well, they do it in terms of working with... under the supervision of or whatever with military forces, and that's a decision those independent organizations make for a variety of reasons. I would argue some good, some bad reasons. But I also like to add to the confusion by pointing out that it's not like the military forces are uninterested in the humanitarian objectives, the humanitarian concerns. The fact of the matter is mm-hmm. that no soldier, no professional soldier, wants to see the ravages of war extend to those who are non-combatants. And some of the problems in Afghanistan were caused by, you can almost characterize excessive exuberance on the part of some to pursue a humanitarian mission for a variety of reasons, again, some good, some bad, that causes the lines to blur. The fact of the matter is American forces want to be perceived as the good guy. They are concerned about humanitarian issues and will try to help those that they can help within the parameters of the mission. And in some cases, as in Iraq and Afghanistan, it's fully recognized that humanitarian and development assistance is an essential ingredient of success on the ground.
It's hard to pry those apart, but a whole new chemistry emerges when they get quite that close. General William Nash, thank you very much for being with us today. We're grateful to you for joining us.
Thank you.
A retired Army Major General, commander of U.S. Army forces in Bosnia after the Dayton Peace Accords in 1995, William Nash. Phil's calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Phil. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Very well, Phil. What do you know?
Well, sir, I'm a retired Special Forces guy. I spent 30 years in, many years as a Special Forces medic, and I was in the first Gulf War. I was rolled over and actually did the Provide Comfort mission, which is in northern Iraq, and got to work a little bit with Doctors Without Frontiers. And as a retired guy, I've been over doing some humanitarian type work, but not within an NGO, actually, from an academic viewpoint.
And so, how do you see this pairing?
Well, my experience has been that it's really a function of those individuals who are providing the care locally. I've seen Special Forces medics, in my experience, work locally and work very well, although there was a time period, the interim time period, when some trust had to be engendered between the two groups, especially with all due respect to Doctors Without Frontiers, because they're a wonderful organization.
Médecins Sans Frontières or Doctors Without Borders, yeah.
Without Borders, sorry. It was a military organization that was coming in, and they were doing seeming paradoxical work that is, providing humanitarian care. And what General Nash just said with respect to caring, I mean, the guys that I worked with totally cared. They truly wanted to help in a medical and, preventive medicine fashion and so forth.
But including as a Special Forces medic caring for local civilians.
Absolutely, and I think, and I'm not trying to defend the policy per se. I can only speak at the local level, so to speak. That is,
when someone's in need.
Special Forces medic providing care for the indigenous folks of Afghanistan or Iraq, as the case may be. But it took a little bit of time for some trust to be engendered, but when it did, it did work, in fact. I saw it work and provide comfort. I didn't see them with this local this latest conflict, not in my recent experience, but I know that they're working.
Phil, let me turn to Nicola De Torrente with that, and thank you for your call. What about it? Here's a Special Forces medic. He's on the ground. He sees civilians who are in trouble. Doctors Without Borders is nearby. They end up working together. Are these missions similar? Are they entirely different? What's the distinction that's important to you?
Well, of course, I mean, as General Nash also said, I mean, individual soldiers, there's no doubt that they have feelings of compassion towards other human beings, and that they would like to act on that. That's not the point. The point really is that aid, when it's given by a military organization in pursuit, as General Nash put it, of a political objective, it's aid that is basically conditional. It's aid given to reward those who are collaborating, who are passing on information. It's aid with an ulterior motive, or it's aid that can be denied to, as a form of sanction. It's conditional aid, and that is exactly the opposite of humanitarian aid, which is unconditional. It's based on need. It's based on who is suffering, and who, irrespective of who they are and where they are and the situation they find themselves in. And it's not to say that individual acts by the military are irrelevant for local patients. I mean, if you are treated by a special army medic, if he's competent and qualified, I'm sure that he will do a good job. But overall, this is an effort that is not a humanitarian one, in the sense it does not have the humanitarian motive and motivation.
And yet there's a lot of dabbling with temptation toward integration of these efforts. And you've written about it yourself. You say there's a false promise here.
Well, the problem is that why do we hold on to these principles of independence, neutrality, and so on? It's not because they we love them as such. It's because they allow us to gain the trust of and the acceptance of different armed groups and help us gain access to populations and to reduce the security risks for our team. So they're very operational in nature. Of course, they define what we do. Impartiality means that our aid is needs based, but independence and so on, it's a means to be able to reach people, and that's why we hold on to them and we try to defend them. It's not to sacralize the principles as such, but because they're practical and they help us. And when we work in the Congo, where you have all sorts of armed groups doing all sorts of things, and the need is so huge. You need to be able to, we feel we need to be able to be there and to provide medical care, nutritional care, and so on. And these principles help us to do that. And the efforts by the Army of associating us with their efforts, their politically minded efforts, compromise those principles and undermine them and ultimately undermine humanitarianism. And that's what's dangerous.
Mudafa's calling from Quincy, Massachusetts. Hi, Mudafa. You're on the air.
Hello, sir. How are you?
Very well. What do you know?
I have a great regard to the Doctor Without Borders organization. Mm-hmm. And I am calling for a specific reason. I am from Iraq myself, and I call my family, my relative, and there is a big problem with the kind of diseases which cannot be cured in Iraq, such as cancers. And I am dealing with one case of which the doctor there are trying to cut a lady leg when she doesn't need that, according to the doctor here. So could Doctor Without Borders establish an office in Jordan or a secure city in Iraq to look up this case and communicate with the hospitals or doctors here and a charity organization as well to get those special cases the health care they need?
Nicola Torrente, you hear how urgent and personal that,
I mean,
that
clearly,
interest is.
We're along with many others, we're very worried about the health, the medical situation in Iraq. Things have deteriorated sharply, according to the contacts we have, and the gentleman is just confirming that. He's right. I mean, the problem is that he's right about pointing out secure locations, because we don't feel that we can send any international or national Iraqi staff to work in Iraq. What we are...
You left in October 2004,
yeah,
after the UN bombings.
After the bombings, the kidnappings and killing of Margaret Hassan, the head of CARE, and others, aid workers. What we are working on is, in conjunction with groups of Iraqi doctors, is on setting up a surgical referral facility in Jordan, and alongside also the Red Crescent, and to be able to take care of patients that in the past could have been treated in Iraq, especially war casualties, trauma. There's, given the level of violence, there are many, many cases that need complicated reconstructive surgery and so on, and to be able to do that in a more secure place, a more stable place, and we're working.
What kind of schedule is that on? Mudafa's clearly immediately interested. How soon
now we're
might
doing?
That
yes,
be?
We're in the process of setting that up. We have a team in Jordan right now, and they're working on starting that program to be able to provide referral surgical care for casualties, civilian casualties, particularly from Iraq.
Mudafa, how does that sound?
Yeah, sir, what I am trying to say, all what the gentleman said is okay, and I do acknowledge the security problem in Iraq, but there are cases of which there is no surgeon in Iraq to do a surgery on certain patients, especially cancer problem. And those patients, they are going, most of them went home and wait to die. So what I am asking for is, if there is a phone number, I can communicate with the executive office, and I will prove to them that there is so many technical ways of which we could help people who cannot help themselves in matter of language, money, and also locations.
I need you, sir, says this individual, Nicola de Turnton.
Well, we should get in touch after the show.
Mudafa, please leave your contact information. But it's interesting, and you must have run into this before. I mean, Iraq's a terrible situation, but again, people have immediate personal need there. Mudafa clearly cares about individuals who need this. He says,
absolutely.
Help me now, please.
Absolutely, and this is one of the huge dilemmas and frustrations of humanitarian aid work, is that the needs are so great that we, of course, try to expand our coverage and cover as many as possible, and have done that. And when we work in conflict situations, to not just provide basic care, but also to expand. And for, I'll give you an example. We used to not treat because we were not addressing and seeing the need, victims of sexual violence, for instance, which was a huge unmet need 5-10 years ago. We were not treating that.
In what kind of arena? What countries?
In war situations, in the Congo or in other places. When we decided to try to deal with it. We're treating hundreds and thousands of cases of this. So
counseling, is that what you're saying?
No, it's also medical care and post-exposure prophylaxis for AIDS and other and psychological care. So we're expanding the offer of services, of medical services we're able to provide in war zones, but there are clearly limits. We run up against individual cases of someone with diabetes in a remote location. Or cancer patients, as the gentleman mentioned. I mean, there are patients that we cannot do anything for, and it's difficult to deal with. Because we have to deal with individual, but we also have to look at numbers and what are the types of diseases that kill the most, the types of disease that we can do something about cost effectively in terms of, we can't put all our resources to treat one patient and so on. So these are difficult and tough decisions, but the main idea is to do more and better quality and expand the effectiveness of our interventions. Mm.
Bruce is calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Bruce, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
I want to shift the discussion to Africa, if that's all right. Spent a few years there, first as a Peace Corps volunteer and then as an anthropologist. I recently read a book called Famine Crimes about the disaster relief industry in Africa, in which the author, Alex Duvall, a former aid worker himself, argues that things like famine and outbreaks of cholera, for example, are really not simply health problems or logistical or technical problems. They're in fact political problems that only occur where governments are not accountable to the people they're governing.
Bruce, take us to your question. We've just got a couple of minutes, and I want to get you a good answer.
So, what I'd like to know is how Mr. De Torrente, as a representative of MSF, which Duvall really singles out for criticism, how does he respond to the notion that aid agencies are really just applying a Band-Aid fix on a wound that will never heal as long as that political solution is not addressed in African countries?
We've got it, and we get 1 minute to figure that out.
Well, yes, it's a Band-Aid, but it's an important. You need the Band-Aid first to be able to deal with the political causes that are creating the problem. We're not going to be able to, we're not a political institution. We won't deal with the political causes. We have to apply the Band-Aid, but we have to do it in a way that raises the awareness about the responsibility of the politicians and the groups that are creating the problem. That's why we speak out. That's why we explain what we see. We document and talk about the atrocities we see, the obstacles to providing aid. To call for the responsibility of political leaders. I mean, De Waal is right, and actually, I recommend him for one of your future shows, especially on Darfur. He's someone that you should definitely invite and have here, because he's a extremely knowledgeable person on that context in particular.
But you're going to bring on the Band-Aid, French-based, $500 million budget, $91 million from the United States. What portion of your doctors are American, or your medical staff?
Not enough. We have about 5% of our global field staff is from the United States. So it's an international effort. We're no longer French-based. We're based all over the world.
Fair enough.
And resources have to come from all over, financial, human resources, and support. And so the U.S. is a big part of that now.
There's the call. Nicola De Torrente, Executive Director of Doctors Without Borders USA, thank you for your work, and thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.